I'm Sarah J. White, retired director of pharmacy, and I've always had an interest in effective pharmacy leadership. I want to welcome you to this conversation with a successful leader. The purpose of this conversation is so you can hear in a successful leader's own words how his career evolved and perhaps some tips and lessons that might be useful to you. Because remember, leadership is different than being a good pharmacist. We're going to have a conversation with R. David Anderson, Andy Anderson, and by brief introduction, a review of his career, Andy received his pharmacy degree from the Medical College of Virginia in 1947. He has primarily had leadership positions in smaller community hospitals across this country, but he did practice at two academic centers, the Medical College of Virginia Hospital and Ohio State University Hospital, and he also briefly practiced in community pharmacy. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm just delighted to be here, and thank you for asking me.
In 1976, you received the prestigious Harvey A.K. Whitney Lecture Award. Your lecture was entitled The Peril of Deprofessionalization, in which you really called a spade a spade. How did you feel about receiving the highest honor in hospital pharmacy?
Well, I didn't feel like I deserved it. And in fact, I resisted receiving it for quite some time. I knew that there were many other people who had done so much more and deserved the award far more than I did. But Paul Parker, who had done so much for me and contributed so much towards my career, finally, he urged me and to accept it, and I finally said, well, okay, I'll do it, but I don't think I'm the one who ought to be receiving it. And so that was the genesis of it, and when I realized what I had been given and what I was going to have to do to write a speech or a paper which would be acceptable, it was such an overwhelming effort. I thought I didn't know that I would ever be able to do it. But as it turned out, has been received fairly well. And in fact, as I've had a number of people who have commented on it, and just recently, within the last year, in fact, some young fellow out in Kenya in East Africa got a hold of a copy of it, and he read it, and he was so impressed with it, he convinced the editor of the Kenyan Journal of Pharmacy to reproduce it or reprint it in their journal. And this young lady was given a copy of it when she was a technician in a hospital down in Mississippi, and she was just so impressed with it that she decided that she just had to meet Andy Anderson, and as it turned out, I've become her hero, I guess, and that's just one of the examples of the things that have happened since then, and there have been the other. It was republished, I think, in a number of other journals, but it's interesting that you talk about that, because last night I had a copy of it with me in my hotel room, and I was rereading my Whitney address, which I had not looked at in quite some time, and I'll have to admit, with some degree of, or maybe a lack of modesty, that I think it was pretty good. And it spelled out a lot of things that were going on at that time, which I felt were so important for pharmacy, in every aspect of pharmacy, to look at, because I felt that we were really in great peril of being deprofessionalized by the then activity in the country. And as you know, Phil Schneider just recently presented his own Whitney address, which was called Pharmacy Without Borders, and several of the comments that he made in his address seemed to reflect many of the concerns that I had at that time in 1976.
You've encountered a number of new things in your career, such as the internet, email. I understand you even have a page on Facebook. How have you adjusted? Because you email quite well, you use the internet. How did you learn all those things over your career? Obviously, we always have had to learn new drugs, but all of this other new technology. How does one do that, Andy?
Well, I guess necessity just made it imperative that I began to work with some of those things. And I can recall even when I started at the Waynesburg Community Hospital after having been at the Ohio State University Hospital as the assistant director there with Cliff Latchley, I didn't even have a typewriter to start with. I had to bring in my own typewriter from home. But later on, we began to pick up on a number of these things as it became available, and somehow or other I was able to convince administration that this was something that we had to do. Card Selectric typewriter was one of the first pieces of technology that we really had, and that was a very complicated thing back in those days, and everything had to be on these cards that you could make everything from labels to form letters, or even develop programs for the P&D committee, agendas and things of that sort that have to be put on a card, which was kind of punched out in a way. So that was one of the early things. And then as the internet became available, I needed that kind of information in order to get in touch with other people who have been my mentors, leaders, and teachers for so many years. And so it's been a major contributor, I think, to my own work. And even after retirement, I continue to work with that technology to be in contact with missionary pharmacists around the world and to encourage young pharmacists to be involved in organizational activities and things of that sort.
Early in your career, describe the value that you found in going to professional meetings.
That was one of the most exciting, stimulating thing that I was ever able to do. And I go back so far and went to the very, very early institutes, we called them back in those days, which were the preceded the development of the mid-year clinical meeting in the American Society of Hospital Pharmacists. And I can recall going to these institutes where there might be 125 people at maximum. They were nearly always held at some college of pharmacy, and we stayed in dormitories, and you get $12 a day or something like that. It was really a great opportunity to begin to develop some of those relationships that remained with me for the balance of my professional career. And even today, there are people that I met at ASHP institutes back in the early 50s that I continue to consider such wonderful friends. Not many of them still living, but some of them are, and that was what really began to stimulate me to become active and interested in organizational affairs. And I'm sure that those are places where I first met some of these people who then later became so involved in ASHP. I don't know that I ever really met Harvey A.K. Whitney Sr., for whom we owe so much in the way of organization of ASHP. He was the first president, the organizer and developer of the organization. And I don't know that I, for sure, that I ever met him, but I think I sat sort of spellbound at his knee at one of these institutes and listened to him and was just literally spellbound by what he had to say and the encouragement that he was giving we young folks to move ahead and to create situations where patient care could be improved through better pharmacy service. So that was the beginning, and then almost for the last 50 years, I guess, since the early 50s, or even 60 years almost, I've tried to attend every ASHP annual meeting and mid-year meeting that I could possibly attend, and they're always so structured in a way that you can't help but learn, and you can't help but continue to be enthusiastic and desirous of the opportunity to meet and know young people and learn what they're doing. I've often said that I've never had an original idea in my life. I've always stolen everything from somebody else, and then I've tried to elaborate or develop it or increase its usefulness in some other way that I might be able to add something to it. But most of the work that I've done has been the result of seeing what other people have done, and which I've learned primarily at institutes and mid-year and annual meetings. It's been a great experience. I had never met Cliff, for example, until I went to an ASHP institute at the Ohio State University. He hadn't been there any time at all. And probably less than a year, and he was sort of running that whole program. And as I left, or the day that it ended, Cliff and I were sitting in the lobby of the Student Union building there, just the two of us sitting on a sofa or something. And he mentioned to me that he was looking for an assistant director. And I said, would I qualify? And Cliff said, well, I don't know. Put in an application. So I put in an application. At this time, I was at the King's Daughters Hospital in Stanton, Virginia, in 59 or 60, I guess. And so I put in the application, went out for an interview, loved what I saw, came back, talked with my wife about it. She said, well, you're the boss, you do what you think is best. So I went back for another interview, went to the College of Pharmacy, met the dean and other faculty members there, and was told that if I took this position as assistant director, I would also have to teach the course in manufacturing or industrial pharmacy in the School of Pharmacy. And I had never turned a wheel on a tablet machine in my life. I didn't know any of those equipment, even though I had spent a lot of time earlier at the Medical College of Virginia when I first graduated from the School of Pharmacy there. And I spent a lot of time in the manufacturing department, sort of ran that department to the MCV hospital. And that's a whole new story about all the things we were doing there, but didn't have the kind of equipment they had in the manufacturing lab at the College of Pharmacy. And so there I am with Cliff as assistant director in his department and running the manufacturing lab in the College of Pharmacy. And Cliff is continuing to sort of lead me along and build me up and giving me the opportunity to do the things that later became so useful to me. At that time, Cliff was also the president of ASHP. And so he was gone a great deal of the time traveling and leaving me pretty much on my own to run the pharmacy department. I'd come from a place I had no help at all. I was the only pharmacist at King's Daughters Hospital. And I go to this place here, we had about 40 pharmacists and technicians, and I had to run the whole thing when Cliff wasn't there. And it was a great, great learning experience. But my wife and family were never happy in Columbus, and so when we had an opportunity to go back to the Valley of Virginia and another small hospital there where I felt like I had really begun to develop and grow at the King's Daughters Hospital. Waynesboro was only 9 miles away to the east at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Skyline Drive and the Blue Ridge Parkway. And we just felt like we wanted to get back to that sort of environment instead of the big city environment. And then as a result of that, all that was going on at Ohio State, where we were doing everything at that time with the residency program, I began to, again, picking the brains of those people or what I'd learned at Ohio State. I said, well, here, a lot of that stuff we can do here. And I started off, I had no help at all. I had one fellow who couldn't read or write. He could only be told, you pick up this box here and you put it over there, and he could do that, but he couldn't do anything else. So I finally got rid of him very quickly and then began to develop the program with other technicians and support personnel. And so that was all a part of learning from people like Parker and Latchley at the time. But there are others. Every other one, I think, in the ASHP presidency that I had known before and during those institutes and so forth were very instrumental in many of the things that I eventually did.
Did you have a master career plan?
Never gave it a thought at all. Wasn't interested in it.
So how did that come about then?
Paul Parker, this name's going to come up many times during this interview, I believe. Paul Parker, again, had such a tremendous influence on my career. I was the first president and organizer of the Virginia Society of Hospital Pharmacists. I served as the president for the first year and the second year. Very early in that program, we invited Paul Parker down to speak to the society. We were so small. At that time, when we first organized, you could count the number of pharmacists in the whole state of Virginia on the fingers of two hands. And but Paul Parker agreed to come down from APHA, where he was the director of the division of hospital pharmacy at that time, and speak to us, sort of our keynote speaker. And after that program was over, Paul and I were sitting at the bar of the John Marshall Hotel. Of course, you couldn't serve alcohol back in those days in Virginia in bars. But we were having, we might have had a beer, I don't recall, but Paul and I were sitting there, and he began to urge me to get involved more in some of the things that's going on in ASHP. And so I eventually was appointed as a member of the Committee on Safety Practices and Procedures. Eventually I became the chairman of that committee myself, and the previous chairman had moved on up into some other position in ASHP. And so from there on it sort of began to develop, and I then got into other programs, other committees, and eventually on the board of directors. And again, never ever feeling that I would be qualified for or could undertake the position of president. Strangely enough, I was nominated. And when I was nominated, I said, no, I won't do this. I reject it. I can't do it. I'm not qualified. I don't have the people. I can't possibly leave my job at the Waynesboro Community Hospital with as much traveling as is required, because I only at that time had one other pharmacist on the staff. Parker got on the telephone with my administrator and convinced him that this is going to be good for your hospital, and you need to give this guy enough help so he can do what we want him to do. And so the administrator, Barry Kennard, finally agreed to allow me to employ another pharmacist. So there, at that time, there were three of us actually, all in the pharmacy department there, and I finally accepted, okay, I'll do this, but I only because Bob Lantos was the other nominee. And I knew that Bob Lantos was bound to be elected because he was so much better known. He'd done some research and development. He'd been in a big hospital down in Texas. And there was no chance that I could be elected president of ASHP. So I said, okay, I'll be the fall guy. You can put me up. And as it turned out, somehow or other, I was elected. And even then, I said, well, I don't know that I can do this, really. But Parker, again, came to the forefront and encouraged me to do whatever was necessary to do. So that's basically how I got into it. And it was just a sort of a normal course of events in working in this organization and knowing so many people at that time on the board who continued to work with me and provide the support that I needed.
So on hindsight, was that a good experience for you, being president?
Oh, it's a wonderful, wonderful experience. I would encourage anybody to head in that direction who possibly could. You cannot believe the advantages that it provides in meeting other people, all the travel that you had to do. I don't know how many states I was in, and the speeches and addresses that I had to give, not only throughout the United States, but in Canada. I was a keynote speaker in Cannes on the Mediterranean, and where I embarrassed Joe Otis to death as I criticized pharmacists everywhere for their inability to perform the way that I felt they should in providing for better care for patients. And so you had all of that, and as a result of that, many other programs or opportunities came up for me to be involved in other things because of my association with ASHP. And they had to do something with the old presidents, you see, and so Joe Otis got me appointed to the Joint Commission on Prescription Drug Use, which also involved a lot of international travel and all over the United States, taking testimony from everyone that had anything to do with adverse drug effects and trying to develop a program for a centralized unit to develop a facility for collection and analysis and distribution of information about adverse drug effects and drug problems. And again, meeting many, many, many people who contributed to my understanding of what was going on in modern healthcare.
During your presidency, the required APHA, ASHP dues, I'm sorry, joint membership came sort of to a head. Could you describe a little bit about the context of that, the process that was used, and the outcome?
ASHP, as we've already discussed, came out of APHA in that Gloria Franke and Paul Parker were serving as executive directors of the Division of Hospital Pharmacy of APHA. And so we had this affiliation arrangement with APHA, but unfortunately it required that every member of the American Society of Hospital Pharmacists also had to be a member of APHA, and in order to be a member of APHA, you had to be a member of your state society, and if your state society had affiliated chapters or groups such as the Shenandoah Valley chapter of the Virginia Pharmaceutical Association, you had to belong to the local chapter, the state chapter, and also APHA. We had ASHP and also had state affiliated chapters of ASHP, so this created a great financial burden for hospital pharmacists of those days, and we tried desperately for an almost 3-year period to get APHA to accommodate us somehow or other so as not to require this joint membership, which was creating such a financial burden for hospital pharmacists. So Joe Otis and myself, Wendell Hill, who did a marvelous job as subsequently he was president of ASHP, with the three of us, and I believe Paul Baumgartner, another subsequent ASHP president, were working with Bill Apple and George Griffin Hagen and other people on the board of APHA trying to come to this affiliation agreement, which would provide for some reduction in the cost of membership for ASHP members. But Bill Apple, a man who I respected tremendously, simply would not budge from his position. We had to continue this same affiliation arrangement or else. And so after almost 3 years of negotiation, we just felt like we couldn't continue this. And so in 1972, we went to the House of Delegates of ASHP and presented this proposal that we had to disaffiliate, and I believe it passed almost unanimously in the House, and in spite of a great deal of debate about the necessity and the value and the problems associated with it. And but we did disaffiliate, and at that point our membership just shot through the roof because people could afford ASHP when they couldn't afford all this other membership. And I believe record will show that we jumped from about 7,500 members up to about 15,000 members in just a matter of a few years. So it proved to be one of the great things that ASHP had ever done. I don't claim any credit for that. In fact, I got a lot of flack from people in APHA for having led the charge to disaffiliate, but I don't claim that at all. Claim no credit for it, and I'm not at all sure that I deserved a lot of the criticism that I got from APHA members and board members and so forth for what happened. But I'm glad we did.
Interestingly enough, I was a delegate in that House and voted and remember the issue.
Oh, sure.
But thank you for sharing that because it is sort of a history of where we've come from.
Well, I might also say that at about the same time we were involved with virtually every other pharmaceutical organization in the country trying to come to some sort of what Joe Otis termed as a commonality of purpose. There was a great effort at that time to try to develop an umbrella organization which would speak for all of pharmacy. And getting back to my Whitney address, that's one of the things that I felt then strongly, that there was no such organization and there never would be such an organization that could speak for all of pharmacy, because we in hospital pharmacy, we work in a different environment, we work with different people, we work with patients on a one-on-one basis with nurses, physicians, and others, and that simply is not the case in community pharmacy, manufacturing, PMA, all those people. Everybody's got a different focus and a different the values that they look at, and to this day, I don't believe there's any possibility for that kind of organization with a common purpose like that.
If you think about your Whitney address, how have things changed since 1976 in this whole area of professionalization within hospital pharmacy?
At that time, I was greatly concerned, as the title demonstrates, that there was great possibility and peril that we were being deprofessionalized and people were trying to delegate pharmacy, not just hospital pharmacy, but all of pharmacy, to a technical status. That there was so much evidence of the fact that people were not depending on pharmacists for anything significant. People didn't talk to pharmacists, physicians didn't talk to pharmacists, nurses weren't interested, and everybody was simply saying that we didn't account for much. And so that was my great, great concern. And it is still a concern to me even today that we are in a position where people are trying to discount the value of pharmacy. And we see technicians taking over so many of the responsibilities that pharmacists once had. And they can do most of the work that pharmacists did back in the early days with little or no education, whatever. So those were some of the great concerns that I had then and still have. One of my main efforts was to try to encourage people to become more and more efficient from the standpoint of the clinical pharmacy. And I felt that we really needed to begin to develop that concept. There weren't many what we call clinical pharmacists back in 1971, the early and late 70s. And the fact of the matter is, in Virginia, where there was only one in the Medical College of Virginia School of Pharmacy, I hired the second clinical pharmacist in the state of Virginia at little old Waynesboro Community Hospital. And so I pointed out, I think with some degree of emphasis, that we had to move in that direction. And as a result, and I don't claim again any credit for this movement, whatever, but the clinical pharmacy program development program began to develop. And today, it is a striking change compared to what we had back in the early and late 70s and so forth. So again, I don't claim any credit for that, but it did begin to move. And particularly in the university settings where we had residency programs and so many people have become such experts in drug therapy, people who know, pharmacists who know far, far more than most physicians know in terms of drug therapy. And so we are so blessed that we have that kind of development that has brought us out of the dark ages of lick and stick and count and pour.
Andy, the majority of your career has been in what's typical in this country, smaller community hospitals. However, when you first got out of pharmacy school in the kind of mid to late 40s, you worked at the Medical College of Virginia Hospital, a university setting. At that point, what did hospital pharmacists do? What was practice like? To give our audience sort of in the late 40s what hospital pharmacy practice was like.
Well, I think I mentioned before that at that time there were no hospital pharmacists, or very few. In the state of Virginia, there were, as I said before, I think you could count the number of hospital pharmacists on the fingers of both hands. There were two or three at this major medical center, the Medical College of Virginia. There were absolutely none in Northern Virginia. There was none in Roanoke or Southwest Virginia. There was one at the VA hospital in Richmond. There was one or two, I think, at Norfolk General Hospital in Norfolk. And I was the only one in a small hospital anywhere. And we were involved, I guess, primarily in maintaining floor stock arrangements. Every hospital had every nursing station had its own supply of a multitude of bottles of pills and tablets and capsules and and oral liquids and so forth, from which the nurse made the decision of which one of these am I supposed to give to this patient. And we were doing some manufacturing. I did quite a bit of that, certainly at MCV when I ran that program there. I was just thinking last night about anti-asthmatic mixture, which was about the only thing that we had to treat asthma with back in that day. And it had tincture of belladonna, tincture of hyoscyamus, tincture of lobelia, tolu balsam, and I don't know, 14 other things added to it. It was a god-awful mess you ever saw in your life. Tasted terrible, but it was the only thing that we had. We made tons and tons of NF antiseptic solution, which is basically the same thing as the original Listerine. I made sulfanilamide ointment. Was the only thing that we had to treat burns and major skin infections, sulfanilamide. This was at a time when we had virtually no antibiotics. Penicillin in those days, the very early days, was still being reconstituted from the urine of patients who had received it. We had to, they collected the urine and reconstituted the penicillin so they could give it to other, cleaned it, of course, to sterilize it, and made sure that it was still penicillin. Streptomycin had just arrived on the scene. Dihydrostreptomycin followed that. Eventually, Aureomycin followed that. So I've seen every major development in drug therapy in the history of the world during my 60-plus years in pharmacy. But back in those days, pharmacists had no involvement whatever with drug utilization, selection, and monitoring. We were simply there as storekeepers, sending drugs to the floor when the nurses sent their empty bottles down, and we refilled the bottles, put them back up, and at that time I hope we were changing labels, which nurses had already done, in pen or pencil, which was still legible. And many thousands and thousands of mistakes were being made because of the poor quality of the labeling of those things.
And that was called a floor stock system.
Right.
Because literally the nurse had these stock bottles
she had
on her unit.
She had a pharmacy on every floor, or every nursing unit.
So what was the drug distribution system like when you got there?
Just like I said, okay. They had a little small pharmacy on every nursing unit.
So what changes then did you make?
Well, I was still enamored with the idea that we could make all these pharmaceuticals back in those days, and so I began doing a lot of manufacturing, and I even made procaine sterile solution for injection, or Novocaine as some people might call it today, and such things as back lotion and the Listerine or NF antiseptic solution and so forth. I probably spent several hundred dollars on chemicals and supplies of that sort, many of which I never used because I really began to realize that, heck, I can do more things than this that are more useful to our nursing and medical staff and patients than doing some of this other manufacturing and compounding and so forth. So that began to change very quickly. We were also involved in making all of our sterile irrigating fluids, and which I was doing in the pharmacy and having to send these to the floor to the central supply room to be sterilized there, and we distribute, label and check and distribute those from the pharmacy. And so that was just another aspect of it that quickly comes to mind, and trying to begin to develop better relationships with the medical staff, pharmacy and therapeutics committee, which is almost unheard of back in those days. And another idea again that I picked up at some institute somewhere, and it just began to snowball.
And you then went to Ohio State as an assistant director. Now, how did you get from Ohio State, when your family wasn't as happy in Columbus, Ohio, back to Waynesboro?
Well, we always took our vacations and come back to Stanton. I guess the last summer that we were there on vacation, I just happened to know the administrator at the Waynesboro Hospital, because he had been in the course on hospital administration run by Mr. Cardwell at the Medical College of Virginia Hospital when I was working in the pharmacy. So Barry Kennard and I had known each other even back then, several years, well, got it 10 years earlier or more. And I just happened to go by to visit with him, and he said, well, I need a pharmacist here. He had just some part-time help, I believe. And so it didn't take long for us to decide, well, we're going to jump at this opportunity. And as I say, it was probably the biggest professional mistake I ever made. But in retrospect, I never would have been able to have done the things that I did, because if I continued at Ohio State, I would have been living and working in the shadow of that great man, Clifton J. Latchley, and would never have been able to get out and do the things that I was able to do with the support that I had at Waynesboro Community Hospital.
So that may be a lesson about don't burn bridges. You never know who later might be of help to you, correct?
Well, right.
So how did you go about developing, and what did you find at Waynesboro when you got there in terms of the systems, and then how did you go about developing? You were the director there for 23 years, I believe.
Well, it was pretty sad, and I mentioned earlier that I had no help to start with. Pharmacy itself physically was just a room with some shelving and a bunch of bottles of pills and so forth. And it was, again, a floor stock arrangement on every nursing station. They all had all the drugs they thought they needed, and they were sending the requisitions down with the empty bottles, which we refilled and sent back to the floor. And eventually, with all the experience that I'd had previously working with Ohio State and certainly with the Committee on Safety Practices and Procedures, I began to realize how many mistakes and errors were being made. And something had to change. So it wasn't long before I realized that unit dose was the only thing that we could really do that would resolve many of these problems and improve the care that our patients were getting. So I quickly began to look at that very seriously. Of course, we had no money, had no equipment, nothing to go on at all. But I said, well, we're going to do it one way or the other. And I developed some fairly unique ways of trying to deliver drugs in unit doses. And I could go on for quite a while describing some of the things that we did were probably not, it certainly compromised the quality of the drugs, I guess, when we got through with it. But it certainly was a way of getting up there to the floor in a way that the nurses didn't have to make those selections and make those decisions that they previously made, because everything was labeled up until the time that the patient received the drug.
So how did you learn about how people were doing unit dose?
That came from Ohio State. As I say, I never had an idea of my own. I stole it from Larry Shaup, who was one of our early residents at Ohio State when I was there. And Shaup started one of the very early unit dose programs up on 10 Central, I believe it was. I realized, shucks, if they can do it, or we could do it at Ohio State, we can do it here. And Larry didn't have any more equipment, any more knowledge of it than I did, but he started it and he developed it and it began to roll. And so I said, well, I can do this as well. Unfortunately, I had so little help that it eventually overwhelmed us. And I finally said to nursing, I'm sorry, I've got to give this up. And I went to the administrator and said, I can't do this anymore. It's working us to death. And so then he authorized some additional help, and then we picked up again, just began to roll. And then eventually we got into IV admixtures. I got the hospital auxiliary, the ladies who sort of helped run a lot of the volunteers and so forth. They got them to purchase a four-foot laminar flow hood, and we began to develop our IV admixture program, the first in the state of Virginia. Our unit dose program was the second in the state of Virginia, but it turned out, I think, to be the most comprehensive unit dose program, and nothing went up to the floor virtually except maybe some cleaning supplies that we were providing that wasn't in unit dose. And then our IV admixture program began to roll, and we had very, very tight control on that, which the nurses had no control whatever, and it was done in the most germ-free atmosphere you could think of when they did it on the floor. we were doing these things in the laminar flow hood and providing a fair amount of control that was impossible in the nursing unit. And then we even looked at another idea that somebody had was doing syringe pre-filling. So in our small laminar flow hood, we started developing this program of syringe pre-filling and providing a complete syringe, labeled syringe to the nursing unit so she could give the drug without having to draw, reconstitute, draw up, and take this unlabeled syringe to the nursing, to the patient's bedside. And so we began to develop that kind of control, which obviously we never had before. And I think, again, we were one of the very early ones in the country to do that sort of thing. And then a dear, dear friend, Zachary Hannon up in Long Island, had found this little syringe infusion pump that was used primarily in research laboratories for animals, dogs and rabbits and rats and so forth. This thing was not much bigger than that. And they had found that this thing could drive a 10 ml syringe over a period of 20 minutes or 10 minutes. You could adjust the time, but there was nothing else you could do. There were no bells and whistles. There was not a thing that we could do except put the syringe in there, hit the start button, and it would gradually push that plunger on the syringe. And so we began to send up, we reconstituted bulk antibiotics like cefazolin, and withdraw that in 1 gram for 20 ml syringes and label that, freeze them, and then eventually thaw them out when they were needed in a microwave to send them upstairs at the time they were needed. These were things that nobody else was doing. And every syringe infusion pump you see today with all the bells and whistles and multiple channels and so forth all began as a result of that little bitty pump that we were using.
So all of these have been innovations. They took a lot of extra time and effort. Why do that?
Well, I never did it looking for glory or anything of that sort. It was just a necessary thing to make sure that patients were receiving good quality care with little or no possibility of the side effects, infection, and to make sure that the doses were correct. And we talked all the time about giving the right drug, the right patient, the right dose, the right time, and those kinds of things. And this was one way to accomplish that. It was to make it available to the nurse in a ready-to-use form that she had no manipulation whatever to do.
So how did you implement clinical services then in Waynesboro? Waynesboro was roughly 170 beds, something like
that. About that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, again, there was another thing I felt that we just had to do. I could see so easily that things were going not as well as they should. And the fact is that this is the point in time I wrote an article published in AJHP entitled The Physician's Contribution to Hospital Medication Errors. Cliff Latchley said, don't do that. We are not ready for this. We can't criticize physicians. And I felt we had to criticize physicians because they were doing so much that was wrong and was hurting people, patients. And at this time, the whole clinical pharmacy program was just beginning to develop. And as I said, there was one clinical pharmacist at the MCV hospital, or at actually the School of Pharmacy. And I said, well, we need that sort of opportunity and good work done in the small hospital just as well as they have in the teaching hospital. So I hired the first clinical pharmacist in the state of Virginia outside of MCV. And Ed Jones, who came to us from Duquesne University, began to develop that whole program there, and an immediate acceptance on the part of the medical staff. This guy can help us. We can do things better, and patients are going to benefit from it. So I think the medical staff accepted Jones, and then eventually we had other clinical pharmacists come on. He moved on to the Cleveland Clinics. Big step up for him, and we had other people to come in and take over that program. And other things developed out of that. I don't know if you'd want to consider, but we developed the shared clinical pharmacy program for three hospitals in the Shenandoah Valley, at King's Daughters Hospital, Waynesboro Community Hospital, and Rockingham Memorial Hospital in Harrisonburg. And we had a clinical pharmacist then who was serving all three hospitals and on a rotational basis. No one had ever done this before, except that an attempt had been made up in Maine to do it. The three hospitals that had also previously had developed a shared CT program, so that they had a mobile CT scanner moving between the three hospitals. And I said, hey, if we can do that with a CT scanner, we can do this with clinical pharmacists. So I was agreeable to giving up my clinical pharmacist to head up this program, then he would rotate between the three hospitals. And eventually, all the hospitals developed their own improved and increased clinical pharmacy programs. And today at the Augusta Medical Center, which replaced both Waynesboro and King's Daughters Hospitals, the Augusta Medical Center has about five clinical pharmacists on staff, whereas before we only never had more than one.
So did you do clerkships for MCV while you were at Waynesboro?
Well, one of the greatest things that I ever did was to be involved in clerkship for students at MCV. I had so many young people to come in and spend time with us, and it was one of the most pleasurable things that I think I ever was able to do, and felt so good about being able to mentor these people and encourage them to go on and do these things. And I can give you a couple of examples. Of one of my very first candy strappers was a young girl, probably no more than a sophomore in high school, and I again began to see that she has got potential. This girl is really bright, and I kept working with her. I said, you need to study pharmacy when you get out of high school. And Kit Nichols then went on to study pharmacy at the University of Kentucky, where Paul Parker was located, and she graduated in pharmacy there, took a residency, and eventually decided, well, she wanted to go into medicine, and so she became took her medical degree and then a residency in pediatric medicine. And today she is the director of the regional health department in Central Virginia as an MD. And so those are the kinds of things that I felt so good about. And I could give you a number of other examples where young people came in from MCV in a clerkship program that I was able to encourage to go on.
So what advice to other mentors, because this does take a little bit more time, but it pays off. What advice about how to be an effective mentor might you have?
I made it a point to spend time with them. They weren't there to work. I could say that they were quite valuable from the standpoint of relieving the rest of the pharmacy staff from a lot of the routine duties that we had to be involved with, but I didn't think that was what they were there for. These students were there to learn, and I wanted to be sure that they had every opportunity to learn as much as we could possibly give them by allowing them to do all the things that the pharmacists were doing, not to just put them in a picking station to pick unit dose tablets and capsules and put in trays to transfer up to the floor and so on. These kids had to do everything that they possibly could to learn as much as they could about what was going on in pharmacy and develop relationships with nurses and physicians, which I think is absolutely essential if you're to do a good job as a clinical pharmacist.
What advice do you have for current and future pharmacy leaders?
Well, obviously we are facing a real crisis in pharmacy. I think in this country today, as I've already said, there's still that problem of the possibility of deprofessionalization, and as I mentioned earlier, we recognize what Phil Snyder said in his recent Whitney address, that there's a real wake-up call, and we are going to be out of the picture if we don't develop some additional opportunities to improve and impact better patient care. I'm really not sure what else we can do. I've got to think a lot about this, and I think it's a major concern that ASHP, and every other health-related organization that involves pharmacists has got to consider what is our role. Because with the information transmission is so easy today, physicians have got all the information that they need on their PDAs or their laptops that they carry with them. They don't need pharmacists anymore to provide the answers to a lot of the questions that they might have. We have got to realize that our role is being decreased, I think, instead of increased at this point. We've reached the peak, I believe. Maybe we got a little bit further to go, but if we don't do something else to involve our people more effectively in patient care, we're going to see a decrease in the role of the pharmacists in healthcare today, because there's still so many people at the community level who never speak to their pharmacists, patients who never ask to be counseled, pharmacists who never offer to counsel, sign here please, unless you want the pharmacist to talk to you. And the same situation occurs in the hospitals. I think there is another problem, that we are not spending enough time with patients. And we've got to be in that role in order for the pharmacist to understand what the effects of drugs are and to be able to direct drug therapy. I believe the time has got to come when we are in a situation where we can prescribe more and more and more, or have total responsibility for prescription. Physician diagnose, we prescribe, the nurse administers. Other than that, I think we're in grave danger.
So is it an issue of us sitting down at this point and seeing what unmet needs around medication exist and then creating those niches to move into?
I think that's a pretty good assessment of the situation, yeah.
I mean, if you think about what you did when you went to Waynesboro, you looked at what needs were there, how could medications be better used, how could patients be better served, and that's sort of the same challenge, mm-hmm. to keep doing that over our sort of service evolution, perhaps.
You're absolutely right. That's the way we've got to keep moving in order to develop that special niche that only pharmacists can provide and no one else can do. But as I said, with information transfer the way it is today, with the technology that we have, our role is going to become less essential, I think. But we still need to move forward to get that closer association with patients and certainly with physicians and nurses.
As you think back over your career, Andy, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
Strangely enough, I think it's been working with nurses and students.
Why?
I feel that I've been able to do a lot of things that have reduced the work and the worry and the concern that nurses had about delivering drugs. They used to have to do it all under some of the most archaic conditions. We've taken a lot of that manipulative paperwork and so forth out of the hands of the nurses, and they have recognized that, hey, things are better, they're safer, and these people have really helped me in my work, and they've taught me a great deal. And certainly our many, many lectures that are given over the years to nursing staff in order to improve their understanding of drug therapy have been another great thing from my standpoint and given me such great satisfaction. And I think the other thing is working with students who've been such an inspiration to me, in that I wanted to be sure that they understood as much as I could possibly provide for them the information that we had that I felt that they needed to know. And so I think those are two of the major satisfactions. And I would have to say travel and meeting people has to be the other. And I'm not sure if that ought to be on the top of the heap or the bottom of the heap, but it has certainly been without a doubt a major satisfaction for me in all the years that I've been involved.
So at a professional meeting, if someone sees you, they shouldn't be intimidated to come up and just talk to you.
Oh, absolutely not. I relish the opportunity, and I felt like I've have really influenced the career choices of a fair number of young people, and find that so satisfying from my own standpoint that I've been able to do that.